What we're going to do is to touch on a few of the central elements of Richard Nixon's political career. For those of you who are listening on tape, this evening is May 1st of 1994. Dick Nixon finally shuffled off this mortal coil a little over a week ago. Ever since he relieved us of his presence, the media have been filled with some revisionist history and revisionist journalism, frankly, under the circumstances, which was at the same time as predictable as it was disgusting, and for the knowledgeable, I suppose, to a certain extent at least, unpalatable. The importance of studying the activities of Richard Nixon, the importance of studying Richard Nixon as a political animal, is that in examining the life of Richard Nixon, one is not so much examining the life of an individual as much as, in my opinion anyway, one is examining the life, the political life, of an entire nation in a particular period of history. And beyond that, I think in examining Richard Nixon's political existence, one is examining in microcosm not only the past, but the present, and I suspect what is likely to be an extremely unpleasant future for the human race, for this planet in general. The story of Richard Nixon as a political animal in the United States and on the world stage is the story basically of fascism in America, and beyond that, the ascension of fascism in America and its consequent triumph on the world stage. It is my considered opinion that this country and this world are sliding headlong into fascism, and that sometime, probably early in the next century, even the most conservative political analysts and commentators will look about them and they will see a world that is run by and for the devotees of the political philosophy of Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini. And I think that is a political reality which is going to last for a long, long time. It is my hope that that does not happen, but it is my considered opinion that it is going to happen, barring drastic and unforeseen changes in the course of history, the course of human events. And by studying Richard Nixon, by studying where he came from, what he did, what he was held accountable for, and beyond that, and even more importantly, what he was not held accountable for, one is in fact studying more, as I said, than the life of an individual. One is studying the political life of a nation and of a world, and perhaps even of a species, in microcosm, and beyond that, one is taking a look at an individual whose life exemplifies and serves to highlight the failures of the United States of America as a political system in the second half of the 20th century. Since Nixon died, we have been treated to a great deal of, I shouldn't say it's false sorrow, but we've seen an awful lot of people expressing regret over the tragic nature of Nixon's life. And we've seen people talking about what a great statesman he was, and we've seen people talking about what a great president he was. Well, the assessment of Dick Nixon as a great statesman reminds me of the recent statement by Gianfranco Fini of the Alleanza Nazionale, that is the Italian Fascist Party, which is basically a renaming of the MSI, the Movimento Sociale Italiano, the Italian Fascist Party, that is the direct successor to the fascisti of Benito Mussolini. Gianfranco Fini, whose party is part of the ruling coalition in Italy, at least for the ruling for the time being, in a recent discussion with journalists, tabbed Mussolini, quote, the greatest statesman of the century. Well, if Mussolini was a great statesman, then Richard Nixon was a great statesman, and vice versa. I don't think anyone of any reasonable political instinct could possibly term either of them a great statesman, although both certainly have had a tremendous impact on the world in this century. In fact, I view the impact of Richard Nixon and the impact of Benito Mussolini as being virtually identical. And among the things that we're going to be looking at this evening is documentation of just how Richard Nixon's political career intersects with and was conducted in the service of fascism, both fascism in America and fascism around the rest of the world. It is also said that one should not speak ill of the dead. We've heard a fair amount of "let's be kind to the dead" since Richard Nixon died. In my opinion, that's a misplaced sentiment. If you want to be kind to somebody, be kind to the living. They're the ones who appreciate it. I would not waste one's time being kind to the dead. They are in a situation unknown to most of us, and if there's any sort of sensibility at all on the part of the dead, it doesn't show. And it's a safe bet that their situation, if in fact they have a situation at all, in a concrete sense, well, perhaps that's the only situation they have is in a concrete sense, but if their situation is to be administered to at all, it will be administered to by a much higher power than anyone here on terra firma. So, as I say, I think that this breastfeeding and the tears, crocodile and otherwise, that have been shed since Dick Nixon bit it about a week ago, maybe a little over a week ago, those sentiments are misplaced. Be kind to the living. They're the ones that need it and appreciate it. Don't worry about being kind to the dead. Beyond that, I think the intonation, which we have heard so often, that we should be kind to Richard Nixon, that we shouldn't say anything, that we should not speak ill of the dead, is misplaced historically as well as philosophically and ethically. To say that we should not speak ill of Richard Nixon because he's now dead is, to my mind, like saying, well, we shouldn't speak ill of Adolf Hitler or Benito Mussolini because they're dead. In fact, it is important to understand history. It is important to understand just what those who are no longer with us have done so that we can accurately assess the forces that have come out of their actions. We can accurately assess the political milieu of which they were a part, and that in turn, so we can come to understand in a viable sense the political realities which affect all of us. To say let's not speak ill of Richard Nixon is as destructive to my way of thinking as saying let's not speak ill of Hitler or Mussolini because they're dead. It is critical, absolutely essential, literally, quite literally a matter of life and death, to understand the political world of which Richard Nixon was a part. Now, even though we're going to be going up to 11 o'clock this evening, there is no way in hell that we're going to be able to do more than just touch on some of the things that Richard Nixon was involved in. But by examining some of the political resume of Richard Nixon, it is my hope that we will come to understand more about the world in which we live, more about the political forces that shaped Richard Nixon, because they, unfortunately, did not pass away with Richard Nixon's demise in the first third of 1994. On the contrary, the forces that created Richard Nixon, the forces of which he was a part, are very much with us as I speak on the evening of May 1st, 1994. The forces that shaped Richard Nixon and the forces of which he was a part are the forces that have come to dominate the earth, and they are the same forces that created Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini, and they are the same forces of which Hitler and Mussolini were integral parts. We're going to begin this evening by touching briefly, simply by way of brief archival allusions, to the early career of Richard Nixon. We're going to talk about the stewardship of Richard Nixon's first congressional campaign. That was conducted by Murray Chotiner, a mob attorney. Some of the financing for that campaign came from Los Angeles mob boss and Lansky protege Mickey Cohen. We are also going to take a look at Jerry Voorhees, the first political victim of Richard Nixon. Voorhees was defeated by Richard Nixon in his first congressional campaign, chaired by Murray Chotiner to a large extent and financed in part by Mickey Cohen. Interestingly enough, Jerry Voorhees was very active on the floor of Congress in lobbying for the breakup of IG Farben, the Nazi chemical cartel. In fact, the IG was broken into its member companies, but they continued to wield a profound influence, not unlike the trust-busting, quote-unquote, of Theodore Roosevelt. In fact, by taking a look at the early career of Richard Nixon, we can come to understand how early on Richard Nixon became, in effect, a servant of the forces of fascism. With the elimination of Jerry Voorhees, who was defeated by Richard Nixon, a key congressional opponent to the breakup and a disempowerment of IG Farben was eliminated. In fact, that breakup and that disempowerment were never actually effected, and we are all very much the worse for that. Richard Nixon, of course, also gained a lot of political mileage out of his, quote, investigation, unquote, of Alger Hiss, who eventually was convicted of perjury. We're going to take a look, and this, again, by way of brief archival references and perhaps reminiscence, we're going to take a look at Alger Hiss, who was the special counsel for the Nye-Vandenberg Committee, which was instrumental in disseminating information to an unknowing American public about the collusion between major corporate interests in this country, munitions makers in particular, and their counterparts in Europe, in particular those involved with the fascist dictatorships of Mussolini and Hitler. With the political discreditation of Alger Hiss through his perjury conviction and his tarring with the commie brush, that done largely by Richard Nixon, in effect, an entire period and an entire political philosophy, that of anti-fascism, were discredited by association. We're going to touch briefly, very briefly, on Alger Hiss, his political significance, and some of the shadier connections of some of those who were tarring Alger Hiss, such as Dick Nixon, J. Edgar Hoover, Whitaker Chambers, and others. After that, we're going to take a look into, we're going to delve into the archives for the first time, and we're going to begin examining a virulent fascist political movement that fought alongside the Nazis during World War II, namely the Romanian Iron Guard. We're going to take a look at the political fortunes of an Iron Guard pogromist named Valerian Trifa, who went to work for the Reinhard Gehlen Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit during the closing days of World War II. He jumped to the United States along with many of the alumni of the Gehlen organization, became the Archbishop of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate, brought to power through the employment in the United States of exactly the sort of stormtrooper strong-arm tactics that propelled Hitler and Mussolini to power. Later, Valerian Trifa was invited to give the opening prayer before the United States Senate in 1955. The discussion of Valerian Trifa by way of introducing us to the political period in which Richard Nixon first began to thrive in a big way will then serve as a transition to an examination of the very cozy relationship between Richard Nixon and the financier of the Iron Guard, a fellow named Nikolai Malaxa, M-A-L-A-X-A, a business partner of Reichsmarshal and Luftwaffe head Hermann Göring. Just like Valerian Trifa, Nikolai Malaxa took Horace Greeley's admonition, or Horace Greeley's encouragement, I should say, to go west, young man, very, very seriously. He eventually made it into the United States, where he was able to gain sanctuary to a large extent because of the efforts of Richard Nixon, by then a United States senator. We're going to take a look at the relationship between Dick Nixon, Nikolai Malaxa, Bewley, Krupp & Nixon, Nixon's Whittier law firm, and a bogus company, a dummy corporate front, named Western Tube, which was the nominal excuse for keeping Nikolai Malaxa in the country. Legislation on behalf of Western Tube was introduced by Richard Nixon, and interestingly enough, that company never really produced the steel tubing from which it got its name. The mailing address for Western Tube was the Whittier, California law office of Bewley, Krupp & Nixon. That particular stratagem, the Western Tube card, so to speak, was the vehicle for keeping this fascist financier in the United States. Indeed, as I said, an examination of the political career of Richard Nixon is an examination, a survey of the evolution of fascism in America. And it is in examining Nixon's life that one hopes to perhaps in examining his political career, to gain a better understanding of the world that we live in today. Indeed, in 1968, after Richard Nixon was president, he presided over the formation of the Republican Ethnic Heritage Council. That was an explicitly fascist, I shouldn't say explicitly, an overtly fascist element of the Republican Party, incorporating such elements as Romanian Iron Guardists, Hungarian Arrow Cross veterans, and other Nazi and Eastern European fascists who were allied with the Axis powers in World War II, many of them having jumped to the United States with the Reinhard Gehlen Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit during World War II. Indeed, we've looked at the Republican Ethnic Heritage Council formed by a Hungarian Arrow Cross veteran named Laszlo Pastor in two archive shows, one a miscellaneous archive show from September of 1988, and the other, September 6, 1992's installment of Radio Free America 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. After taking a look at Dick Nixon and the Iron Guard, and Dick Nixon and fascists and Nazis in general, we're going to take a look at, quote, the whole Bay of Pigs thing, unquote. That was what Richard Nixon was afraid was going to be revealed if, indeed, the Watergate cover-up was not effected. We're going to be taking a look at some of the more important and less publicized aspects of the Watergate scandal, because indeed Watergate itself, that vehicle for bringing down Richard Nixon, is itself, like the life of Richard Nixon, a microcosm for examining some extremely important political forces. Those forces were identified in a formal sense and dealt with quite effectively in a new book by Peter Dale Scott, the brilliant Berkeley professor. It's called Deep Politics and the Death of JFK. And we're going to examine briefly the whole Bay of Pigs thing, the organized crime, intelligence, fascist milieu of which Richard Nixon was a part, by way of introducing us to some of the more important and less publicized aspects of the Watergate scandal. There's been a lot of press about Watergate, but very little about what it was really all about. After taking a look at a short section of Peter Dale Scott's new work, we are going to delve into the archives once again. Specifically, we're going to take a look at an addendum to The Guns of November Part 3, dealing with the assassination of President Kennedy. The Guns of November was originally recorded in November of 1983. In June of 1992, by way of observing the 20th anniversary of the Watergate break-in, once again went into the subject of the profound connections between the Watergate scandal and the assassination of President Kennedy. Also, the connections between the Richard Nixon political milieu and the assassination of Robert Kennedy, as well as the shooting of George Wallace, were touched on. Those are delved into at much greater length in other archive shows, which I will cite during the course of the broadcast. But Watergate, the Kennedy assassination, and Richard Nixon will be the next focus. That from a June 1992 addendum to The Guns of November Part 3. By the way, this is once again by way of observing the 20th anniversary of the Watergate break-in. We've heard a lot about that, but very little about the truth behind that particular incident, or behind that particular political scandal. We are also, at that point, going to take a look at some other aspects, both of the whole Bay of Pigs thing, the milieu weaving in and out of the story of the Bay of Pigs, and we're going to take a look, first of all, at what freelance Danish journalist Henrik Kruger feels was the deliberate manipulation by Richard Nixon of the federal government's drug enforcement machinery in order to switch control of the international heroin trade from the Corsicans to some of his own Latin American and Southeast Asian political allies. There are substantive indications that Richard Nixon, whose political career was inextricably linked with organized crime, deliberately manipulated the drug enforcement machinery of this country to switch control of the very lucrative heroin trade to political forces directly connected with him. And beyond that, the milieu of the great heroin coup, the milieu tabbed by Henry Kruger as the Internacional Fascista, is indeed the political milieu of which Richard Nixon was a central part, and it is the political milieu which sits astride our civilization today, and it is for that reason that it is important to understand that milieu, and it is for that reason that we are examining that this evening. We're going to take a look at the great heroin coup ever so briefly, and after that we're going to take a look at the milieu behind it, the milieu that winds through Miami, Florida, the milieu that winds through the Bay of Pigs, the assassination of John Kennedy, Watergate, right on up through the Iran-Contra scandal, the administrations of Ronald Reagan and George Bush, and right on up to today. We are also going to be taking a look at what comes of the enfranchisement of a political milieu, such as the milieu that Richard Nixon was a part of. We're going to take a look at one of the aspects of the Watergate scandal that did not receive much publicity, namely the San Diego or Squad 19 conspiracy, an aborted political conspiracy hatched by the political forces that controlled Richard Nixon of which he was a part, to set up a provocation at the 1972 Republican convention in San Diego to blame that terrorist incident on, quote, radicals, unquote, or, quote, black militants, unquote, and to use it to suspend the U.S. Constitution, cancel the 1972 elections, and establish martial law in the United States. Indeed, that abortive plan, aborted because one of its participants, Lewis Tackwood, blew the whistle, that plan gave rise, or was inextricably linked with the development of the martial law contingency plans, which are on the books to this day. And indeed, there are indications that the Squad 19 conspiracy may have been set up and may have been involved with or connected with some of the dirtier of the dirty tricks that Richard Nixon's dirty tricks squad was engaged in. Indeed, they were engaged in some very, very dirty tricks, as was Richard Nixon throughout his political career. That, in a nutshell, is what we have on tap for this evening. We're going to take a short musical break, and when we come back, Richard Nixon's greatest hits. an examination of the political life of Richard Nixon. We begin now with tonight's archive show. It's a look at some of the political career of Richard Nixon. I think I'll kind of call this Richard Nixon's greatest hits. There's a pun there, of course. A hit is a term for an assassination or a murder. And there's abundant evidence that Dick Nixon's been involved in plenty of those. And beyond that, that political assassination was inextricably linked with the political fortunes of Richard Nixon, specifically his rise to the presidency in the 1960s. There is, as I said at the top of the broadcast, far too much in Richard Nixon's political resume to even begin to approach in a serious fashion in the course of a radio broadcast. So what I'm going to do is to allude to some of the references to Richard Nixon's political doings that are in the archives and to sum those up as best I can and to play you some of the others. One might begin in examining Richard Nixon's political career with the very first political campaign that he ever won, namely his defeat of Congressman Jerry Voorhees of California in 1946. Jerry Voorhees, as we saw in Radio Free America program number 2, in turn accessing material from a treason's piece about I.G. Farben subtitled German Dies and American Dupes that was written by Howard Watson Ambruster, A-M-B-R-U-S-T-E-R, published in hardcover by the Beechhurst Press, copyright 1947. It talks about Jerry Voorhees and his role in leading the congressional floor fight to break up the Nazi I.G. Farben chemical cartel, which represented not only one of the central elements in Adolf Hitler's political foundation, it was arguably the single most important industrial concern in Nazi Germany and certainly was a linchpin of Third Reich industry. The I.G. Farben chemical cartel and many of its prominent officers and directors became among the first. They became some of the first civilian entities to be sentenced for war crimes in the post-World War II period. However, as we have seen in numerous archive shows, the denazification of Germany and the war crimes trials themselves were something of a farce and were essentially subverted by forces on the former Allied side, which all along had been allied with the fascist powers of Europe. Industrialists, financiers, political figures, military and intelligence people whose real sympathies were fascist and who had wound up working against the forces of fascism due to international rivalries for empire to a large extent. The breakup of I.G. Farben, advocated by Jerry Voorhees, just like the breakup of the German cartels and the denazification of Germany itself and the eradication of fascism itself, never really took place. It is something that never really got underway. It was subverted from within. And indeed, from the very first, we see Richard Nixon as a political animal serving the forces that benefited fascism when he helped to unseat Jerry Voorhees, one of the leaders of the congressional floor fight to break up I.G. Farben. As we saw in The Guns of, by the way, that is from Radio Free America program number 2. As we looked at in The Guns of November part 3, one of the key people in Richard Nixon's early political career, a man who managed him and discovered him to a large extent, was a mob attorney named Murray Chotiner. Also the same individual who was responsible for Earl Warren's rise in politics. In turn, much of Richard Nixon's, or a fair amount of the funding for Richard Nixon's first congressional campaign came from Los Angeles syndicate boss Mickey Cohen, a protege of Meyer Lansky and Bugsy Siegel. The very first Nixon congressional campaign, as I said, eliminated Jerry Voorhees, and it's worth noting that from the very first we see organized crime connected with the rise of Richard Nixon as a political animal, because indeed not only organized crime but the Lansky syndicate in particular figures throughout the story of Richard Nixon's rise to political prominence. In The Guns of November, or not The Guns of November, in Radio Free America program number 1, looking back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War part 1, and again in part 2, Radio Free America number 2, looking back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War part 2, we took a look at Alger Hiss, whose political tarring by Richard Nixon was one of the central elements in boosting Richard Nixon's rise to prominence and in not only destroying the political career of Alger Hiss, but beyond that in tainting an entire political philosophy and an entire political age with the onus of communism. As we saw in Radio Free America number 1, Alger Hiss had been the special counsel to the Nye-Vandenberg Committee, which had been instrumental in illustrating the collusion between the munitions makers with regard to, first of all, manipulation of the forces that led to World War I, and beyond that, the collusion of many of those industrial concerns with many American corporations and munition makers with the fascist powers of Europe. Alger Hiss was, again, the special counsel to the Nye-Vandenberg Committee, and in his lecture tours was instrumental in establishing or in introducing Americans to the very important, although relatively unrecognized, fact that many of America's most prominent industrialists and financiers were pro-fascist and were actively collaborating with fascists abroad and, as we saw at Radio Free America number 10, plotting to establish fascism here in the United States. Whitaker Chambers, who was the main accuser of Alger Hiss, was himself an individual who kept a life-size portrait of Adolf Hitler over his fireplace. He claimed it was to throw off people from the fact that he was a communist. As a correspondent for Time magazine, Whitaker Chambers systematically, again, we looked at this in Radio Free America number 1, he was instrumental in systematically distorting the news coming out of the war front in Europe. He was distorting it in a pro-fascist fashion, and wound up basically functioning in that capacity throughout his political career. We've also, in the Guns of November Part 2, took a look at J. Edgar Hoover and some of his Nazi and fascist connections. Specifically, the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover collaborated with Interpol, the private international police agency, which from 1938 on, from the time that the Nazis occupied Austria, was inextricably linked with the Third Reich's national security system, intelligence agencies, and law enforcement. And indeed, in a number of different ways, J. Edgar Hoover, another of Alger Hiss's persecutors, J. Edgar Hoover functioned in conjunction with elements like the Sicherheitsdienst, the SS Intelligence Service, and other elements which were absolutely part and parcel to and loyal to the Third Reich, and which were in charge of Interpol. Indeed, a suspect that was wanted by the FBI in 1942 was listed in the Interpol publication as being, quote, of Jewish race, unquote. A rather odd characterization for an individual wanted by the FBI. Indeed, Richard Nixon himself is an individual whose political career is inextricably linked with fascism, both domestic fascism and international fascism. That might sound a little overly cute to some members of the listening audience. What we're going to do now, however, is we're going to jump back almost exactly 10 years. We're going to play a segment from Radio Free America program number 2, The Hidden History of the Cold War, or looking back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War Part 2. This program was recorded in May of 1984, almost exactly 10 years ago. What we're going to be hearing about is, the Romanian Iron Guard, the fascist movement that collaborated with the Nazis, the Romanian fascist movement. We're going to hear about a prominent Iron Guard pogromist named Valerian Trifa, who, as we shall see, by virtue of strong-arm tactics, went on to become Archbishop of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate. In that capacity, he was invited by then-Vice President Richard Nixon to give the opening prayer before the United States Senate in 1955. And after that, we're going to take a look at Richard Nixon and his very close connections to Nicolae Maloxa, a business partner of Hermann Göring and the financier of the Romanian Iron Guard. Once again, the segment of the program that you're about to hear comes from Looking Back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War, Part 2. That was recorded in May of 1984. In addition to my own voice, you will also hear the voice of my former co-host, Nip Tuck, who very capably assisted me with the on-air responsibilities.
And as we mentioned at the break, we're going to be talking now about some of the direct importation not only of Nazism but Nazis into America, and we're going to see the resurfacing once again of that omnipresent character in American politics
Our elder statesman.
Our elder statesman. When the Nazis come to call, Dick is always at home, and we're going to see what part he plays in some of this stuff coming up. Now, first off, a very necessary thing to understand that Dave is going to explain is about the fact of Nazism and the fact that not all of the people who were Nazis were in fact Germans, but that there were several native groups of fascists all over Eastern Europe in particular, as well as groups like the Vichy French and other occupation groups in Western Europe who embraced the Nazis with open arms and, in fact, in many cases even outdid the Nazis in the kind of horrors that the Nazis are most famous for. And I would reiterate again a point I made at the beginning of the show. Some of the stuff coming up in this section is rather graphic. If you have a small child, some of it is rather unpleasant.
Right. Okay, now, as we've indicated, fascism was a very, very popular movement throughout the world, of course, particularly in Europe, but many people saw many different things in it. Some saw it as anti-communist, and it certainly was anti-communist. It was also much more than that. As we indicated, the Nazis themselves were able to parlay their anti-communism into an extremely effective tool for world conquest by infiltrating many places and organizations that they might not otherwise have been able to get access to. Now, there were many other fascist movements throughout Europe which were very closely allied politically, ideologically, and militarily with German National Socialism, with German Nazism. Now, first of all, it should be understood that the Axis was not just Germany, Japan, and Italy, but there were a number of other countries that were actually fighting on the Axis side during World War II, most of them in Eastern Europe. Those countries were Bulgaria, Hungary, Finland, and Romania. Those four countries also were part of the Axis, and this isn't something most people realize, but Finland, Hungary, Bulgaria, and Romania also fought on the side of the Axis during World War II. Now, the Romanian fascist movement was something called the Iron Guard, or the evangelical movement, the movement of the Archangel Michael, okay, of the Order of the Archangel Michael. Now, basically, they're almost always known as the Iron Guard. Their technical name had to do with the Archangel Michael. Now, the Iron Guard were, just like the other European fascist movements, extremely anti-Semitic, and they were very, very bloody. Their atrocities against the Jews were kind of like the Ustashi, the Croatian fascist movement, which set up an independent state in Croatia, one of the Slavic states, which was incorporated and is part of Yugoslavia. They would not just kill people, but they did so in a particularly grisly fashion. They were very, very atavistic. There was a blood-drinking ritual, which was part of the initiation into the Iron Guard, in which each member not only drank some of the other's blood, but also let an ounce of his own blood into a cup, which was then passed around as a sacrament. Now, the leader of the youth wing of the Iron Guard was a man named Viorel Trifa, V-I-O-R-E-L Trifa, T-R-I-F-A. Trifa was head of something called the Green Shirts, which were the youth wing of the Iron Guard, basically just like the Hitler Youth. Now, Viorel Trifa, one of the incidents in history that he is best known for is a vicious pogrom that he set up in 1941, I believe it was, that signaled the start of the Iron Guard revolt. And basically, he kicked off an attempted revolt to overthrow the government of Romania. Now, keep in mind, this is the Romanian fascist movement we're talking about, and he gave a fiery speech which resulted in a bloody pogrom, a slaughter of thousands of Romanian Jews. And it's worth noting that under the Iron Guard's and Third Reich's activities, under the Final Solution, only 300,000 of Romania's 800,000 Jews eventually survived. It was the third largest Jewish community in Romania. They were mostly exterminated, and the Iron Guard revolt, which was to culminate in the ascension of the Iron Guard to power, was kicked off by this pogrom, by a mass slaughtering of Jews, and that was triggered by a fiery speech given by Viorel Trifa.
Now, bear in mind one other thing here, which is that this is not merely for the sake of pointing out the savageries of war, But Vera El Tarifa is going to play a key part in the United States in just a matter of moments as we move along. Now, this book that we're reading from is Wanted, The Search for Nazis in America, written by Howard Blum, B-L-U-M, copyright 1967, Quadrangle Books. And he's speaking about that selfsame speech that started the Iron Guard revolt and pogrom. From the statue of King Michael, Vera El Tarifa delivered the speech which he and Sima had hoped would initiate a new revolt. Tarifa, according to eyewitnesses, began cautiously, talking in a steady, calm voice. Below him, the square was packed with 6,000 listeners, and the crowd continued to increase. "This war started," Tarifa began, "with the French Revolution. The origin of the old world was these miraculous words, liberty, equality, and fraternity. These words liberated the people from one tyrant who had enslaved them and, instead, delivered them to hundreds of thousands of tyrants exploiting these principles. People were never equal, not even in the first days of the revolution. These ideas of equality served a category of people who enslaved others and profited by these confused ideas. These ideas," Vera El Tarifa said, "these ideas of equality served the caiques. The caiques of Europe have intensified their struggle for emancipation at the moment when the revolutionary spirit reached the Rhine. The leadership of the people has fallen into the hands of a group of caiques and Jew lovers who are ruling everything, especially history. The League of Nations has served the interests of Jewry to dominate the world. London has become the center of world capitalism. On the shores of the fabulous Albion, Jewry has found a good place from where it will spread its spider web over the entire world." Trefa's voice now rising, the crowd intermittently shouting and applauding ferociously, he concluded his hour-long speech in a hoarse scream. "Even if Adolf Hitler had done nothing else than wage this huge struggle of National Socialism which leads to the unmasking of the fight against Judaism, he would still have risen to great peaks of history as he blazed a new path." All right, the book goes on to describe how this group of people, thousands and thousands of people, whipped up into a fever pitch, stormed into the Jewish quarter of Bucharest and basically burned it down, killed thousands of people. Going on in the book, summing up, Howard Blum says, "During the three-day Iron Guard revolt, the Romanian press reported that 118 Jews were killed and 26 were wounded." That's what the Romanian press said. "The true death toll, as estimated by Jewish sources, was between 4,000 and 6,000 in Bucharest, and nearly 10,000 throughout the country." That's in 3 days. As Dave mentioned, the figure by the end of the Iron Guard period in Romania was somewhere approximately 500,000 Jews killed, but that's perhaps 10,000 killed in 3 days during the Iron Guard revolt. Okay, moving along. In Wanted, The Search for Nazis in America, it says, and this is a report from the president. This is, Dave, maybe you better fill this in on where this comes.
All right. Now, well, basically what this is a report from, I believe it was the Romanian, an organization of Romanian Jews that was in the United States. Specifically, the Jewish Telegraphic Agency was the actual source for this information. Now, this comes in the context of a meeting of these Romanian Jews, which was attended by a man named Dr. Kramer, last name K-R-E-M-E-R. Now, Dr. Kramer was a Romanian Jew who immigrated to the United States, and although his family survived the Iron Guard horrors, he was very, very active. He lost many of his relatives in the Iron Guard atrocities and in the Nazi atrocities, because eventually they hooked up with the Third Reich, both military and politically, and eventually many German troops were in Romania. And Dr. Kramer was very active against Vera El Tarifa, both during the war when he was attempting to do what he could to sort of ease the situation of Romanian Jewry, and after the war when he pursued Vera El Tarifa.
Okay, so again, this is the president of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, the president reading the report of the Jewish Telegraphic Agency, and it says, "On Wednesday afternoon," the president continued reading, "the Gardist General Staff ordered the destruction of the Bucharest Jewish quarter and the murder of its inhabitants. storming through the Jewish quarter in a mad orgy of killing and destruction. Armed Gardist gangs, that's Iron Guard, killed or beat up every person they saw who appeared to be Jewish. The test seems to have been whether persons encountered by the frenzied Gardist gangs were willing to participate in the massacre. The pogrom, which cost the lives of at least 1,000 Jews in Bucharest, was not accidental, but an integral part of the Gardist insurrection and had been prepared in advance. Perhaps the most horrifying single episode of the pogrom was the, quote, kosher butchering last Wednesday night of more than 200 Jews in the municipal slaughterhouse. The Jews, who had been rounded up after several hours of Iron Guard raids, were put into several trucks and carried off to the slaughterhouse. There, the Green Shirts, that's a faction of the Iron Guard, forced them to undress and led them to the chopping blocks, where they cut their throats in a horrible parody of the traditional Jewish methods of slaughtering fowl and livestock. Some mangled bodies were disposed of by pouring them down manholes to the sewers usually used to carry animal remains. Other naked, headless bodies were hung on iron hooks and stamped Karna Kosher, kosher meat. The organization president had to stop. He needed to compose himself before continuing. The general staff, he finally resumed, which ordered the massacre consisted of Vice President Hori Asima, chief of the Green Shirt Legion, Dmitry Groja, boss of the Legionary Workers' Corps, and VRL Tarifa, leader of the frenetic Green Shirt student movement.
Okay, now, eventually, after, well, we're going to talk a little bit about, in just a second, about what VRL Tarifa did in a tail end of World War II. That's going to come as part of an exposition of just what his activities were in the United States, because after World War II, VRL Tarifa obtained entry into the United States. Now, the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate had been very closely affiliated with the Romanian Orthodox Church. Now, as the Cold War really got underway, and as, of course, Romania was occupied by the Soviet Union as the Axis forces were driven back, and a communist government was set up in Romania. Now, as Cold War feelings heightened in the United States, the fact that the bishop of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate had been appointed by the head of the Romanian Orthodox Church in Romania, which at that time was governed by communism, although they had no perceptible effect on the church itself, aroused a great deal of bitterness and suspicion on the part of a great many people, a great many Romanian emigres in the United States, as well as by the federal authorities themselves. Now, in a really a sort of a violent takeover, the Iron Guardists, many of whom came into the United States at the end of World War II under, for a variety of different reasons, seized control of the Grass Lakes, Michigan seat of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate. And the they did so. They kicked out a fellow by the name of Moldovan, M-O-L-D-O-V-A-N, who was the bishop appointed by the head of the Romanian Orthodox Church. And they basically broke the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate off from the Romanian Orthodox Church. And the man who became head of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate was none other than VRL Tarifa, but he changed his name to Valerian Tarifa in order to sort of maintain his religious front, I guess you might say. So when you hear the name Valerian Tarifa in the passage I'm just about to read to you, keep in mind that's the same fellow as VRL Tarifa, the fellow who gave that blood-curdling speech which kicked off the horrible pogrom and, you know, the slaughtered corpses and so forth, which Nip just read you. Returning again to Wanted, The Search for Nazis in America, by Howard Bloom. While Kramer traveled through Romania and then Israel in a small car he had bought in England, Valerian Tarifa solidified his power as bishop. He now controlled an episcopate with 46 churches, mostly in Ohio, and 10,000 parishioners. The Vatra, that is the seat of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate, the Vatra, which his supporters had taken by force, was now officially his. Bishop Moldovan's legal challenges were defeated. An Ohio district court, reaching its decision in the midst of the McCarthy era, decided, quote, the communistic government of Romania was dictating appointment of its bishop, Moldovan, and the American diocese was entitled to revoke its 1936 bylaws and elect its own Bishop Trefa.